We're going to continue talking about haunted prisons with Ross Allison and David Weatherly. And, of course, we'll get into haunted toys, a little bit of Black Eyed Children, and your calls on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. George Norrie with you, along with Ross Allison, David Weatherly, Haunted Prisons, their latest work, of course. Ross and David, why did, in 1967, Time magazine call the Missouri State Penitentiary the bloodiest 47 acres in America? What was happening there, guys?
Oh, gosh. You know, that prison, that penitentiary, it was probably one of the most violent penitentiaries in the country. And it was right from the get-go. I mean, they intentionally built it to look unfriendly, George. They constructed it in a Gothic style. But very rapidly, it went from being called the greatest prison in the world to being called just the worst place. It was over 5,000 prisoners were held there. It was one of the largest facilities that's ever been built. There was a violent riot in 1954 where 2,500 prisoners got loose. This was so bad that the National Guard was called out. There were police officers from Kansas City, from St. Louis. There was a state highway patrol. They all surrounded the facility during the riot, and they basically didn't do anything for an entire night because the situation was so out of control. All they were focused on was trying to contain what was going on inside and stop any prisoners from escaping. So they surrounded the facility and waited until the next day to breach it. And, you know, guards went in with machine guns, heavily armed, and began to take control of the facility again. But during the course of it, surprisingly, only, I think it was four men who were killed. But one of them was killed extremely violently. It was a gentleman who was an inmate who other prisoners knew was a snitch, mm-hmm. as they say. And they broke into his cell and beat him to death with a claw hammer.
Wow.
And, of course, that's one of the hot spots at that prison now. But this facility, you know, it's open for tours. There's former guards who conduct ghost tours and historic tours there, and they will tell you about their experiences and some of the brutal facts of the place. And they said that at any given time, there were thousands of shivs in the prison, and that's it's basically a homemade knife that inmates would construct from anything they could get their hands on, whether it was filing down a spoon or
glass,
you know,
anything,
grabbing a glass or wood from, you know, the old bed frames back in the day and so forth. And it's pretty haunted. There's some interesting hauntings there. There's one in particular that's kind of interesting. They call him Fast Jack. And it's an apparition that numerous people have seen that they say is wearing a white lab coat. And they believe he's the spirit of one of the trustees that worked for a medical facility.
Gee,
that was on
wandering around the prison, huh?
Yeah, he's kind of a trickster at this point. You know, he'll do things. He's typically seen around the control room and some of the housing units, and he'll come through very quickly. People will see him darting through and going through walls, but he'll also do things. There was an incident where he opened all the lockers, you know, moments after a gentleman had stepped out of the room. He comes back in, and all the lockers are standing open. So, you know, just a trickster type of activity and so forth, nothing malicious. But there are plenty of other disturbing things that happen at the facility because there's people that report, you know, loud knocks, cell doors slamming. A lot of these things are manifestations that we see at a lot of these prisons that are haunted. You know, some of the typical residual sounds probably of bangs and knocks and footsteps, phantom footsteps up and down the hallways and so forth. But it is open for public tours, and it is notoriously haunted.
You both had some strange experiences with Alcatraz. Tell us about that, Ross.
Well, I was actually one of the first teams to investigate Alcatraz. This is before the ghost hunting became so popular. And they allowed my team to spend the night. So they shipped us out there in the middle of the night. We went through the tunnels that they would actually bring the prisoners in. Because, you know, back then, a lot of the spaces that we got to investigate weren't open to the public then. They've now opened up a lot more to the prison if you get a chance to tour it today. But I got to check it out when it was still pretty much run down in a lot of these places. So my first physical encounter was at Alcatraz. Now, if you're not familiar with Alcatraz's history, it started out as a military base, then it became a military prison, then became the state penitentiary, and now it's a national park. So I got to go into what used to be the old morgue. So this is where they kept the bodies before they had to ship them to San Francisco. Now, connected to the morgue is this tunnel that goes down into the underground part of the island. So I was the first to venture down to this area. Now, I had my team right behind me as we were exploring these different areas. And I get into this small room, and this room used to be where they kept the gunpowder because they had to keep the gunpowder cool, so that's why it was all underground. And I get into this small room, just a dirt floor, brick walls, and a ceiling. And I start to make my way across the room, and I turn around, and I want to get a picture of the entrance. So I'm looking through my viewfinder, and I want to get the widest angle as possible, so I start to back up. Now, at this time, the members started to filter into the room. So as I'm backing up, one of the members puts their hand on my shoulder and stops me. And so I pull away from my camera to apologize to the member that I had backed into the corner, and there was nobody there.
Oh.
Yeah, I physically felt the weight of a man's hand, the pressure of his fingers, and it physically stopped me as I was stepping backwards. So I was expecting to see a living person behind me. I was not expecting to see no one.
I love that story. Now, David, how about you? What was your experience at Alcatraz?
Well, mine wasn't quite that dramatic, but it was fascinating nonetheless. At one of the occasions I was on Alcatraz, I was there after hours, and I was having a discussion with a park employee. It's now a national park, for those who don't know. And we were standing by ourselves in one of the old corridors with, you know, cells lining both sides, and very quiet, very eerie, having this discussion, and suddenly there is the sound of a cell door slamming shut. And, you know, in those conditions, I mean, it just, the sound just kind of reverberates up and down. And it seemed very close to us. And, of course, we both looked up and down the hallway. There's no one else in sight. No one else in that section of the building. And this ranger just calmly looks at me and says, yeah, that happens here a lot.
A lot.
And, you know, it was such a statement given the conversation that we were having. And, of course, we investigated the rest of the area, but no one else was in there. And it's another example of the kind of things that occur there. Now, you know, we couldn't even tell if it was one of the doors itself that had physically slammed, or if it was just the sort of spiritual echo of that happening. But whatever the case, it's such an eerie place. It really is, and so rich with history. And a lot of people don't realize that Alcatraz, you know, it's probably one of the most famous prisons in the world, first of all. Infamously known as the Rock because of how difficult it was to escape from. But even before it was a prison or a military facility, the Native Americans in the region said that the island was a place of bad spirits. And when Spanish explorers came through, they noted in their logbooks that the island itself emanated this weird light. And some of the early explorers just noted in their logbooks a bad place.
You could feel it. You could feel it in that area.
Yeah. So, you know, there was something there from a very long time ago that it was considered just a that something was wrong there. Of course, you know, what do humans come along and do? They put buildings there and throw prisoners out there.
Back in 2017, you both wrote a book called Haunted Toys. David, tell us a little bit about this.
Well, sure. That was actually the first one out of the Haunted series. And we wanted to do something that no one else had covered, something that was a bit different. So we settled on Haunted Toys. And It covers a range of haunted objects. Of course, dolls are covered extensively in the book, but also other toys and even games, because you'd be surprised, George, how many kind of disturbing games there are out there that have weird reputations. And, of course, you know, first and foremost is the Ouija board.
Right,
that a lot of people
right.
don't consciously necessarily think of as a game, but the Ouija was promoted widely as a game when it first came out.
Were some of these toys owned by people who died and then haunted?
Absolutely. Yes, that's usually the case. Yeah, there's a story that I like to talk about called it's a little stuffed lamb, and it was owned by a little girl who unfortunately was struck by a car when she was crossing the street. And, of course, when she was holding this lamb, because this was her toy that she kept with her at all times, she was obsessed with this little toy. And, of course, when she was struck by the car, her and the lamb separate, you know, went two different ways. And when her mother went to, after her passing, her mother wanted to bury her with that little lamb, and she couldn't find it. They searched up and down the street. They couldn't find it anywhere. And, of course, after the funeral, when she got home, they found that little lamb sitting on their front porch. And so she, you know, took it into the house, and ever since she brought it home, that lamb would just end up in the oddest places. On Saturday morning, she would be sitting in front of the TV like she used to do when she was, you know, little girl. She'd sit and watch cartoons. You know, it would be sitting, you know, at the kitchen table. And so she really felt that this was her daughter, you know, interacting with this lamb. And so she actually reached out to a paranormal investigator, and they sat down with the lamb and did an EVP session. And they actually picked up what sounded like a little girl crying.
Oh, geez.
And, of course, after that EVP session, when she picked it up, she said that the lamb even felt damp when she picked it up. Well, that night, you know, she always puts the lamb in the bed when she goes to bed at night. And she, for some reason, could not sleep that night. And so she goes into her daughter's bedroom, and there's the lamb on its bed, like always, and she crawls into her daughter's bed, and she's holding that little lamb, and she happens to look up, and she sees her daughter standing in the doorway, and then she just faded away, and she had never seen her daughter since, and that lamb stopped moving. She thinks that during that EVP session, when she heard the crying, it was her daughter crying to say, you know, that she was saying goodbye.
Wow. And it's everywhere. Hey, David, give us a quick black-eyed children update.
Nothing real significant, George. You know, it's kind of curious because over the past year, of course, so many people, you know, such a large segment of the population have been under lockdown conditions and have stayed in their homes as much as possible. And I've actually talked to people who have, you know, mentioned that they just weren't answering the door, you know, if someone came to the mm-hmm. door. There was so much fear concerning, you know, things that were going on. So it kind of makes you wonder how many missed stories there are, I guess. But, you know, accounts do still come in. I received something last week from a woman who said that she was in a parking lot at a grocery store and, you know, had this young girl that she said had solid black eyes tried to go in the store with her, said she wanted to shop with her. And the woman just refused and went in the store. Told someone inside that there was a little girl outside by herself. And, of course, when the employee went to check, there was
gone.
No one there. And these are typical, you know, these accounts that continue to crop up.
You know, I talk to David Politis a lot about his missing 411 theories, and he's a little hesitant to tell us exactly what he thinks is going on. I got to ask you, David, what do you think's going on with these black-eyed children? Where are they coming from?
Well, you know, I wrote the book in a manner that really left it open for people to kind of hopefully do their own research and decide for themselves, you know, because there are so many different potential explanations for what these things are. Honestly, my personal opinion is that they are something something interdimensional. And that sounds far-fetched to some people, but when you start looking at what quantum science has come around to, quantum physics is talking about other levels of existence, other dimensions.
And, you know, the old adage, just because we can't get there doesn't mean something that's there can't get here. And when you look overall at the patterns of these encounters with these black-eyed entities, it seems as if they are able to travel somehow in some fashion that we as humans aren't able to do, because they suddenly show up and they just suddenly vanish.
Why children? I mean, do black-eyed adults show up at these houses?
There are cases of black-eyed adults, and over the years there have been more and more of those. But honestly, I think the guys is children, because what better way to catch someone off guard? You know, as you and I have talked about before, George, you know, as adults, we're sort of hardwired to help a child. If a kid comes up to you in the street and says, "Mister, you know, I'm lost," or "I need a drink of water," mm-hmm. or something, your first reaction is, "Oh, it's a kid that needs help. I'm going to do what I can." So, you know, I find that in these cases, people are their guard is down, because initially they think they're dealing with a normal child that needs something. But there's that psychological battle that goes on when the person is faced with what appears to be a child, yet all of that individual's warning signs are going off that something is wrong. You know, whether it's the hair on the back of their neck standing up, or queasiness in the stomach, or whatever it is. And it creates this weird conflict that sort of draws the encounter out. And then, of course, when it's revealed the child has solid black eyes and that other things are odd, then that sort of pushes the person over the edge, and the flight response usually kicks in, and these people can't get away fast enough.
How did the black-eyed story get to you in the first place, David?
Well, it was spread on the internet for a while in the 90s, you know, through various forums and stuff, sort of the early days of the internet in terms of paranormal information. And I sort of tracked it at the time. It was one of those things that, wow, this is kind of interesting, but it could be urban legend. And then I started getting contacted by people who had had their own encounters. So I took a little bit more notice and started tracking some of the stories down and interviewing people. And then, of course, when I dug into the phenomena, I realized how very strange it was, and how there's not one singular explanation that immediately jumps forward, you know, to explain what these things are. And of course, over the years, you know, so many other people have dug into old cases and so forth and found correlations. I mean, now we have cases going way, way back that have the same pattern as these modern black-eyed kid encounters.
We're
going
to come back in a moment and take promised phone calls with Ross Allison and David Weatherly as we talk about haunted prisons, haunted toys, black-eyed children. Jump aboard with your phone calls, of course, and in a minute I'll tell you what you can expect on tomorrow's Coast to Coast program as well, because they're great programs, because we've got the best staff ever. So we'll be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. On our next Coast to Coast program, Dan Cummings joins us to talk about his work in the field of conspiracies. He's had a 20-year career as a comic nationwide, but he is into this in a big way, so he'll be our first guest. And then later on, we'll talk about how to influence other people on Coast to Coast. And welcome back to Coast now. George Norrie with Ross Allison, David Weatherly. Their book is Haunted Prisons, Haunted Toys, and The Black-Eyed Children is David's books. Let's go to promised phone calls now. Joe in Long Island, New York, welcome to the program. Hey, Joe, go ahead.
Yeah, I have two questions. Dave, I'd ask you about the black-eyed children. You said they had oddities, but would the oddities be more their behavior than any other physical characteristic that they're displaying? And then for Ross on the prisons, I'm surprised that there were larger prisons built back in the 1800s. From the, you know, just with the funding itself, it seems like it would be a lot of money to do that. And also, do you see in the designs of these prisons from the get-go kind of an insidious plot, in a sense that they would build the solitary confinement cells right into the prison? Or, you know, similarly, for example, at the concentration camps, someone had to go in and make those showers into gas chambers. So there had to be workmen that designed that in for the intention to do what they did do.
Take that, Ross. Go ahead, and we'll get yours, David, right after that.
Well, I do know, like, when you're talking about Eastern State Penitentiary, which was one of the first major prisons built in our country, again, their main focus was solitary confinement. So they literally kept the prisoners from each other. And they found that situation where they were trying to reform, unfortunately, it drew the prisoners mad because of the solitary confinement, not having interaction with another living person. I mean, it was so bad that the prisoners weren't even allowed to interact with the guards. They do situations like the guards had to put socks over their shoes so that when they walked through the prison, you couldn't hear them. So you have to understand, too, when it comes to the first prisons, a lot of times when they built these prisons, it was just one per state. So you didn't have as many prisons as you do today. So it's definitely interesting when you dig into the history of all this.
And David, the Black Eyed Children portion.
Yeah, I'll add one thing too. Also, George, to what Ross was saying, bear in mind that a lot of these early penitentiaries, the prisoners all worked. We talked about Missouri State Pen. You know, there were 6 shoe factories at that penitentiary at one point. So these prisons, a lot of times in the early days, paid for themselves.
A lot of free labor.
As to the question about the Black Eyed Children, the oddities really are kind of across the board because aside from the solid black eyes, there are other things that people notice in terms of physical appearance. No one ever sees a blemish on these children. And we're talking, you know, very frequently kids that are preteen or early teen is what people are seeing. No pimples, no freckles, nothing else. Very often the skin is described as being very pale. And some people even say it looks somewhat artificial. So there are oddities in the physical appearance as well as in their mannerisms and the things that they say. You know, they don't speak in terms that you would expect a modern teenager to speak in.
No, they don't. Let's go to Todd in Naples, Florida, on the wild card line. Welcome to the program. Hi, Todd. Hello, Todd. Nope, there's no Todd. Nope, he's gone. All right, let's try Mario in Alaska. Welcome to the show. Hi, Mario.
Hey, hello, fellas.
Great. Go ahead, sir.
To take over the territorial court building in Anchorage, Alaska, was built in 1939, WPA project, FDR. Behind that building was a territorial holding federal prison. It was a holding prison. Now, nobody ever wanted to go in that building. I ran that territorial court building for 4 years. Now, I went in there twice. I went in there once. I didn't really want to go in there.
That was it. You'd never go back again. What do you think? Have you ever been up to Alaska, Ross?
I've been on Alaska cruise. That's probably the best of it. But I know me and David are talking about doing an Alaska trip and hitting some of these spots that we've written about.
Well, there you go. Looks like there's some activity up that way, huh?
I'm all for it.
Bill in Columbus, Ohio. Welcome to the program, Bill. Take it away.
Hey, George.
Hi, Billy.
This is about the Ohio Penitentiary. It was built during the Civil War. It's a pretty gruesome place. They used to have electric chair executions. And, you could hear after they closed it, it was 20 years, and then they finally tore it down and made it the Blue Jacket hockey rink. So,
geez, they played hockey over that land?
Yeah, and it's also the brewery district where they actually, you know, have bars and clubs and stuff. But
and they actually say that place is haunted, too, because when the prison was there, there was a situation in, I think, in the 30s where the prison caught on fire, and guards refused to let the prisoners out of their cells. So, like, over 300 men died on that grounds right there.
Yeah. They used to bury them in the yard.
Oh.
They couldn't find out who the people, you know, the relatives were. They'd bury them in the yard. So, you know, there was a lot of very bad stuff when our.
So they built things right over the bodies, huh? Oh, not good, Ross.
No, it's perfect for a haunting, though.
You got that right. Let's go to Brendan in Austin, Texas. Welcome to the show. Hey, Brendan, go ahead.
Hello. Thank you, guys. It's always a pleasure. So the first half was about safety, and that's kind of my question, too, is I'm an experiencer, and I do EVP work, and I was wondering if you guys had ever heard of, you know, people that believe in or psychics or witches or use manifestation. They believe that intention is everything. And once you put that intention to use that, you know, let's say a digital recorder or a spirit box to communicate with the dead, with other methods that people use to communicate with the dead, like scrying or seances or Ouija, you close the session afterwards. Have you ever heard of people using seals or binding their ghost equipment to prevent attachments?
I'll let you take that, Ross.
Well, I've heard all kinds of different practices. You have to understand that when it comes to the paranormal field, it is a very diverse field. And so that's one of the things that we kind of struggle in trying to identify and try to prove the paranormal is because there is no set structure on how it should be done. And so you get a lot of different beliefs and practices when people want to try and communicate with the other side. So, yeah, there's all kinds of different elements when people want to dabble in paranormal research. So, yeah, I've heard all kinds of different things like that.
Do either one of you know John Zaffis, who has done some extensive work on haunted possessions?
Oh, sure. He's a good friend. In fact, the three of us went to Moundsville Prison at one point and had a very curious experience in one of the rooms, only the three of us in there, and something was responding intelligently to knocking sounds that we were making on inside the room, and we would get responses, and it was pretty baffling.
Like knock knock, who's there, huh?
Exactly.
Pretty much.
Let's go to David in Columbus, Ohio. Hi, Dave, go ahead.
Oh, hi, George. My aunt and uncle bought a clown marionette at an antique auction.
Oh boy.
Well, they brought it home. Well, the first night they brought it home, they hung it up in their collecting area. That same night, the clock fell off the wall, plates started flying, and they tried to figure out what was going on. Well, the following night, the puppet ended up in their bedroom, and they didn't know how it got there, and the room got solid cold. Well, and then finally they did some research on it. It was made by a Jewish person that got killed during World War II, and they're carving it, and they end up selling it themselves because they said then the house got back to normal again. And and I want to ask your guess, is toys always haunted by the owner? And I'll hang up and listen.
All right, David, do you want to take that?
Well, they're most frequently haunted by the original owner, I believe. And when you look at toys across the spectrum, the most frequent haunted toys are things that resemble the human form. So that's why we see so many dolls that are haunted. And very often this is a case where, you know, if it's a child that owns the doll, they give it a portion of their energy because, you know, to them that is a companion to some degree. So they, you know, they will frequently name the doll and, you know, give it much affection and keep it with them all the time. So we get different degrees of how something is haunted and maybe why it's haunted. Very frequently with these objects, it's not something negative necessarily. But over time, you know, there are things that can happen that instill certain negative energies in some of these objects.
Absolutely.
And then, of course, you know, when someone ends up taking it home, there's any number of reasons why that particular doll may have been manifesting those types of things, you know, whether it was a trauma that the original owner experienced or whether a portion of that owner's consciousness is still with that marionette somehow.
Let's go back to Alaska. Dave in Fairbanks, Alaska, west of the Rockies. David, take it away.
Hi, good evening. I have a comment for you, George, and a question for your guest. The first comment, George, or the comment I have is you should visit Alaska. Your show starts at 9 p.m. Alaska time, so you have a lot of fans here. So it'd be nice if you came up to do a convention or something. Or just, you know, just have some fun. You're always welcome here. You have a lot of fans. You may not know that, but you do here in Alaska.
I love it.
My question to the guests is this. As you go into your investigations, and like to the prisons especially, and you're experiencing suffering souls, you know, I can imagine the EVPs you've gotten are sometimes horrific, asking for help or whatever. Do you then ask a priest or someone to come in and do a blessing? Are there certain prayers that you do? And if you haven't done that, I think you should. But I just think my question is, do you do that? When you experience suffering souls in a location, do you try to lessen that suffering, whether it be through your own prayers, or do you bring in somebody like a priest or minister in to do a blessing? And I'll take your comment or your answer off the air. Thank you.
Good question, David. Ross, you try that first.
Well, I've always believed that if you are dealing with something that is suffering or trying to, you know, ask for assistance in any way, then, yeah, I would definitely steer the correct people in that position to help guide the spirit on. I don't practice that myself. I'm just here to document and try to validate these experiences. But, yes, I do feel that if there's a tortured soul, I will do my best to get the right person involved to help that soul move on.
David, have you ever had to do that?
Yeah, sure. And, you know, I would add, too, that it's a bit more complicated than it seems on the surface, because you have to understand that currently, you know, a lot of these haunted locations, they're controlled by, you know, sometimes foundations, sometimes individual owners. And a lot of times these people don't want anything like that to occur on the premises, whether they're making money because the location is haunted or whatever the conditions are. There are restrictions sometimes on doing things like that.
Absolutely.
And I will add that I have spent some time in Alaska. And of course, George, we talked about the book I wrote on Alaskan cryptids and monsters.
Mm-hmm.
And, it's an incredible place. Absolutely incredible.
It sure is. Ross, I will see you in Everett, Washington on September 25th. All right.
Looking forward to it.
Thank you, Ross. You too. And David, of course, thank you again. We love your work. You're always welcome, my friend.
Thanks, George. Great talking with you.
David Weatherly, their websites are all linked up at coasttocoastam.com. The book we've been talking about primarily tonight, Haunted Prisons, but we also dabbled with haunted toys. And we've talked a little bit about some of the black-eyed children. For Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean Lottasaur, Stephanie Smith, Chris Burrows, Tim Badal, George Knapp, and Ian Punnett, I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.